Lectionary Lab Live is recorded in the studios of the 405 Oxford Group, Gainesville, Florida, and Brasstown, North Carolina, a Two Bubbas and a Bible production. Welcome, everybody, to the Lectionary Lab Live. I'm John Fairless. I'm here with my Bubba, Delmer Chilton. Say hey, Bubba.
Hey, Bubba.
Hey, man, it's good to hear from you. We're getting ready to talk a little text for the second Sunday in Lent. These are the texts for March the 16th, 2014. We got good stuff to go through here today, Bubba. Just a little program note. I think most folks will see that we have two choices in the gospel lesson today. One of those being the passage from Matthew, which I think most of us probably did a couple of weeks ago for the Transfiguration. In some traditions, that is used on the second Sunday in Lent. We're not going to be talking about that since we've already covered that previously. But otherwise, what do you think about starting in the book of Genesis today with our text and kind of working our way through down to our old buddy Nicodemus in John's Gospel?
Sounds like a plan.
What about God's call to Abram, starting there in the Genesis chapter 12?
Well, you know, it's always good to revisit these. Mm-hmm. You know, we refer a lot to Abram's call of Abram and that sort of thing. And every once in a while, it's really important to take a good look at it because there's little subtle things you don't notice. And I've noticed something I hadn't really thought much about before,
okay.
And that's that second line. I'm going to walk through it entirely, mm-hmm. but I will bless you so that you will be a blessing. And I think that is a pretty clear one dynamic that walks throughout the whole of the Hebrew scriptures, mm-hmm. is the question of why the chosen people were chosen. And most of the time when you have conflict, it's because they have forgotten why they were chosen, which was not for themselves, but to be a blessing to the world.
Yep.
Over and over again, this is, and you know, my hobby horse, the grace in the Bible. God came and picked up Abram and said, I will make of you a great nation. I'm not rewarding you for being one. Mm-hmm. And I will bless you and make your name great for a purpose, but for my purposes, mm-hmm. which is so that you can bless the world. I am going through you to bless the world. I will bless those who bless you, curse those in so that all the families of the earth will be blessed.
Yeah.
The universal nature of God's love. I mean, some people get upset about why would God pick a little insignificant country? This is just tribal God kind of thing. I've heard this kind of expression from some people who are challenging the notion of God's calling, and they haven't read the text. Well, they haven't seen underneath what is going on throughout all of this, is that God has chosen Israel for the purpose of saving the world, yeah. as it were.
I think that's an excellent foundation that you're pointing out. I think it's important for us to remember. I think later that same motif or this same underlying motive is important for the church to remember. And
right.
We, at our peril, forget that the blessing of God in our lives is so that we may in turn be a blessing. And when we try to turn it internally and say, oh, no, it's for us, it's for me, and we try to get narrow and exclusive, and, you know, I don't want to get off on my hobby horse particularly either, but I do think it's an important foundation to note. Why the blessing of God? Well, the grace of God has to start somewhere. And we're going to talk about Abram today. Why did God pick Abram? You know, I don't know, but God did. And the grace of God starts somewhere, but it is for everywhere. It's for all people. It is all families of the earth.
And since this story of Nicodemus comes up so often, and you may have preached as much as you feel like your folk can stand mm-hmm. on Nicodemus, mm-hmm. or as much as you know to say, and want a fresh take, this would be a great text. This is a great text to preach a sermon on Lent about remembering who we are mm-hmm. as a Lenten kind of discipline, and saying, why are we? Why are we on, you know, our friend Joe Smith's favorite thing is to complain about calling it a journey, but mm-hmm. it is. Mm-hmm. And Abram starts the journey. Well, why? What's the purpose? Where's he going? This would be a great kind of text to walk through to remind the congregation back to its roots of why are we who we are? Why are we doing this? Why are we church? Is it about so I'll feel good, I get recharged in my batteries, my family, the family that prays together stays together? All that's true, but if it's only about that, mm-hmm. we can meet those kind of relational needs somewhere else, some way. The church is about being blessed so that we can be a blessing.
Yeah.
And if we forget that part, we've messed up. Walking through this text, the first verse is pretty important for a sense of being called. The business of go from your country and your kindred and your father's house. It just pounds it on.
Mm-hmm.
Your country,
right?
Your friends, even the house you grew up in. You're going to have to leave if you're going to follow me.
Mm-hmm.
That's a intense kind of challenge. Most of us have felt that those of us in the ministry, the ordained ministry, have felt it at one time or the other most of the time. But it's not just physical. It's also, it may be attitudinal. You may stay in one place and still move from where most of the people you're with and around are because you have a different attitude at times because of the gospel.
Yeah.
And because of God's call.
I quote a mentor of mine quite often on the show, and Henry Blackaby, I remember saying it like this: you cannot stay where you are and go with God. And that's the quintessential presentation here for Abram. And I think you're right.
Yeah.
I may not leave my geographical or physical location, but I cannot simply remain who I am and the way I am and go with God spiritually. And you're right. I think it makes a good way to think through this process or the journey of Lent. So continue.
And the other thing I remember, my ordination sermon, I jokingly say my first one out of three, but that's twice as a Methodist, once as a Lutheran, but my one I count as my ordination as a deacon in the United Methodist tradition. Bishop Joe Thomas, African American from South Carolina, who was Bishop of East Ohio, and he said to us young pastors there at Methodist College in Fayetteville, North Carolina, he said, God will lead you somewhere you don't want to go. Because if you wanted to go there, God's leading would be unnecessary.
Another good way to look at it.
And underneath this for the rest of the day is the key element, I think, for both our reflections about Romans and about Nicodemus and Jesus, is that this is all of grace. Abram has done nothing. He just shows up.
Yeah.
You know, the Lord said to Abram, get up, go.
Yeah.
There's no reason that we can think of as to why God would have picked him.
Yeah. Abram provides the one necessary ingredient as the passage closes. So Abram went, as the Lord had told him. The obedience piece. But you're right.
The obedience piece.
It's not something that he had worked up and won the heavenly lottery, you know, the sweepstakes. Okay, Abram, you're the lucky winner, so I'm coming to pick you. Now, we don't know all of God's work and, you know, foreordination and choice and all of that. It is all of God. It is all of grace. The one thing Abram is willing to do is what God asked him to do.
These three choices really are a fulcrum on which the Hebrew scriptures change direction. Mm-hmm. Because the first 11 chapters of Genesis are basically a story of human sin, kind of various Tower of Babel and floods and all these things going wrong. And God's ultimate response becomes grace and says, here, this becomes a history of salvation from here on out. It becomes the story of how God interacts with us and provides God's grace to us.
I'll buy that for a dollar.
All right, let's move on.
Let's move on. Let's take a run through Psalm 121, perhaps not as directly connected in this line of thinking, but, I mean, what can you say? Truly one of the outstanding passages in the book of Psalms asks a great question at the beginning: where does my help come from? and then gives us the answer.
And one of those things is sometimes when people read this, they look up to the hills and they think it's a kind of looking to the hills, looking for God to ride over the top of the mountain on the white steed, you know. Mm-hmm. It's really more like raising your eyes in desperation, looking up and saying, oh, what am I going to do? Mm-hmm. Where is my help coming is kind of the tonality. Where am I going to get help? And then the rest of the answer is my help comes from the Lord. From God. This is really a poem about the promise of God to Israel, and it's kind of a poetic expression of the same covenant we just read about in Genesis, of God's relationship with this people. Hold on, God's present, God is with you, and will be with you to lead you through so that you may be a blessing to the world. As you say, it's beautiful on its own, but in the context of that covenant relationship, it's even kind of deeper.
All the more reason to realize that we don't have to have the God who shows up like Gandalf just before the last battle, you know, in Mordor, coming over the hill as the sun rises.
Right.
And, you know, it's not that. It's the God who's always with us. God hasn't been asleep. God's been with us as wherever our feet have trod. God has been there and will be there. Verse 6, interesting language. We had some discussion around this in our workshop a few weeks ago. The sun, we think about that presenting a real danger. I mean, you can get heat stroke, you can get dried out, and these were a desert people. They understood being shielded from the sun. The moon by night doesn't sound quite so threatening. We often think, oh, well, that's nice. What a lovely moon. It's a harvest moon. It's, you know, all these kinds of things. But this is in a time when the moon, the lunar expression, was often thought of as, you know, lunacy. People are, you know, you sort of lose your mind. There are scary things that happen at night. The night terrors. Yeah, that's it. So it really is. It's that expression of the God who is always with us, daytime, nighttime, wherever we may go. And again, I just think verse 8, one of the nicest summary lines in all of Scripture. The Lord will keep you going out and you're coming in from this time on and forevermore. That says it all, folks. So, a great passage. Well, take us into Paul a little bit then, and we're continuing through the midst of a very theological passage for Paul in Romans. As you say, we're heading towards Nicodemus and a classic encounter with Jesus. What do we want to say about this text in Romans?
Well, here Paul is explicating, I think, without even having to think much about Jesus and the Christ, he's kind of explicating Abraham and the issue of faith versus law in a kind of, this is a Jewish understanding, if I'm making sense here. The relationship of Abraham with God was really one of grace and not of law. And it predates the Moses. When you talk about the issue that the law brings wrath, but where there is no law, neither is there violation in 15. Mm-hmm. Underneath that is the understanding that Abram took place before the issuance of the law.
Correct.
So Paul is making an argument that says our relationship with God is not based on obeying the law. Abram didn't even have the law to obey. What Abram had was a promise of God and a trust in God and believing God's promise. So throughout this, as Paul does his usual rolling through, is that dynamic, is that Abraham's relationship with God and Sarah's is based on a graceful offer of God, not any obedience to the law. So you have if Abraham was justified by works, he has something to boast about, but not before God. I mean, the language goes in circles. But and he keeps piling on the evidence, but underneath it all is this core moment that happened back in Genesis where God pulled him out and said, ask him to follow, and Abram went.
He went.
Abram obeyed.
Yeah, he found a way to have faith. That's what the passage said. This is why it depends on faith. You know, again, I realize we always have this tension between how much we do and where does even our faith come from to respond to God.
Yeah.
It does come from God, but there's the hinge. And on the one hand, you could say Abram didn't do anything but believe God.
Yep.
Now, that resulted in some pretty significant actions, but yes, it is all of grace, but it all does depend on faith. When I said obedience earlier, I certainly didn't mean to imply that Abram then became somehow a fulfiller of the law and did all these kinds of things. No, it's actually the opposite. He just had faith.
Who knows how that moment, that's the mystery moment. Take it away from kind of God and trusting in God. It's like the old sermon illustration about the man who walks across Niagara Falls, whatever famous aerialist, you know, walking over the line and walks across and back. Then he gets out a wheelbarrow and he says to the crowd who's cheering, he says, "Do you believe that I can walk across again?" And they say, "Yeah." "Do you believe I can take someone across?" And they all say, "Yes." And he said, "Who wants to go?"
Yeah.
"Who wants to get in the wheelbarrow and let me push him across?" Mm-hmm. And what is that transitions from that moment of you've seen it, you know it can do it, you believe he can do it, and the willingness to put your weight down on it? I don't know.
Yeah.
I mean, that's where we get a lot of the theological debate of credit, or does God just whoosh you into, whoosh, that's a kind of a Nike swoosh, you know,
yeah.
just
right.
Happen, boom, and you have faith, or I don't know.
Yeah.
You know, I look back and I know when I didn't, I know when I did. Mm-hmm. It's kind of like C.S. Lewis saying, I got in the sidecar and to go to the zoo with my brother. And when I left, I didn't have faith. And when I got there, I did. And what happened in between, I don't remember.
I don't know, but I can remember when I didn't have it. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
And I don't know. And if you try too hard to define how that happens, I think you're stepping too heavily into what Paul refers to at one place as the mysteries of God. Mm-hmm. You've got this great line in Genesis, and tying back there, go through these three verses, I'll do all this, and it just says, so Abram went. It doesn't say why.
Yeah.
You know, and you got here, so Abram was justified by works. He had something to boast about, but he didn't. It just says Abram believed God, and it was reckoned to him as righteousness.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
That's a pretty good lead-in now. Let's move to the gospel text in John chapter 3. And I think that's a pretty good lead-in to what goes on here between Nicodemus and Jesus. In a way, Nicodemus is the one who's trying so hard to figure it out and get it right and know all the ins and outs and be sure.
Right.
And Jesus has this very interesting and at some points quite mysterious conversation with him about how the Spirit works and how this thing happens. And then, of course, becomes the context for, at least in the evangelical world, maybe the Bible's most famous verse, John 3:16, gets so lifted on its own, beautiful language, but gets so lifted on its own out of this context. I love reading it in the context here of what Jesus is doing with Nicodemus and in the context of all of our scriptures for today.
Right.
So let's carry that on.
Well, one of the things, Fred Craddock, in his book that he did with several other people called Preaching Through the Christian Year, says that the basic theme here is that abundant and eternal life is a gift from above, from God, not attained by achievement, claim, or proof. This is a great reminder at the beginning of Lent that though prayer and fasting are important, they do not earn us anything.
Mm-hmm.
And I like that line. He says that this is a conversation between two religious leaders that we're overhearing. Verses 1 through 15 here are kind of that conversation used by the author of John to sort of lay out a program. And then 16 and 17 are the theological summary of the conversation you've just had.
Right.
And John, in his gospel, uses a lot of these summaries that you'll come upon that if you take them out, as you said, out of their context, you've missed a lot of the flavor, you know, of where he's going. First of all, the question that Nicodemus and Jesus are talking about, you might imagine a talk show and a couple of guys from different religious traditions over a cup of coffee having a conversation about salvation. And the question is, how do God and human beings relate so as to please God and redeem the world? Now, at night here, and I've heard a lot, and I may have preached once or twice before I delved more deeply into it, have had this kind of notion where we had a more strict division between the people following Jesus and the Sadducees and the Pharisees, and we almost had this image of Nick sneaking around to talk to Jesus.
Yeah, I don't want my buddies to see me, so I'm going to slip in and have this conversation. Yeah.
But more recent look at this and other studies have kind of shown it's not meant to hint that Nick is afraid to be seen talking to Jesus. It's more a writer's kind of atmospheric symbolic of Nicodemus's murkiness about God. And it's a signal by the writer of John of mystery and misunderstanding. It really is, in John's way of doing things, a way of saying, here's a place in which it's dark and we're going to try to shed some light, and it's going to be confusing. And always remember, when you read anything in John, he's always using double meanings. This happens all the time. Remember the woman at the well. You want some water? I'll give you the water that is eternal life. He's always doing that as a way of pulling people deeper into these conversations to think about what they're talking about. Here we have this dialogue about being born from above. Nicodemus is one of those folks who, as a teacher of Israel, has a man who has a faith that he wants signs. He's one of those people looking for signs. It's interesting that we've kind of built this kind of monolithic vision of what Judaism would like, but it was vast, and there were lots of traditions. And Nicodemus appears to come from one of those that is aware of the ancient tradition, but they like current signs and wonders kind of stuff. For no one can do these signs that you do apart from the presence of God. I know you're one. I don't want to call it charismatic or Pentecostal so much as it is just wanting to see something. And he's seen things, so he's aware he's from God. He's trying to sort it out and see how that works out. And then here's an interesting double meaning. When he says, no one can see the kingdom of God without being born from above. And Nicodemus said, how can anyone be born after being grown old? Can you enter in a second time? And how can one be born again? It came out the King James. And it's interesting how we have latched on to Nicodemus's misunderstanding. Jesus never said born again.
Right. Born from above.
He said born from above. And Nicodemus is the one who said, how can one be born again or a second time? And I don't know what to make of that, except it's just fascinating to me.
Another one of those moments we seem to stumble into from time to time here on the lectionary lab. You just go, Well, I never thought about it like that.
and so what I will say is, it's something you can spend some time thinking about from your whatever tradition you come from. And I'm casting aspersions on, but I believe there's a very important point to being born again. Lutherans like to say we're born again every morning. We wake up every morning, confess our sin of the day before, pray to God. We have a day that we do better at being the saint we were born to be, pat ourselves on the head to remember we're baptized children, and move on. That's our vision of being born. It's continually born as one of God's children. So it's what did he mean?
Yeah. What's very helpful to me from that is the emphasis on remembering Jesus says born from above, and continuing then to use that to help me understand the ensuing conversation, born of water and the Spirit, and where that leads us into this, I think, fascinating illustration in verse 8 between the Spirit and the wind. You know, the wind blows where it chooses. You can hear it. You don't know where it's come from. You don't know where it's going. This is how it works when you're born of the Spirit. I see that as a companion to your idea of being born again every day. Where's the wind going to blow me today? Not that it's totally chaotic. Not that it doesn't have any purpose. It has a great purpose, which makes the Genesis reading all the more important for today. There's a great purpose here in the work of God in the world, but it is not just something that happens one time. It is not just an event to be sure I have my name written down in the book of life. It is always going on. Just as the wind is always blowing, the Spirit is always moving. And in a way, we are continually being reborn, being opened to the possibility and the opportunities that God brings.
This ties back to that question that we sort of ended with in Romans and back to Genesis. Why Abraham and what did he do? And the answer is, that's where the wind blew.
That's where the wind was blowing. Yeah.
You know, I mean, that's as much of an answer as Jesus gets. And there is no answer except the Spirit comes upon, and somehow that moment happens and people respond. Do not be astonished that I said to you, you must be born from above, because look at your history, he says to Nicodemus. That's what happens. It lands on these prophets all through your time, on Saul and then David. He really is looking, asking them to look back and see their own history from the way in which God has operated with them from grace and from lifting up people for the benefit of Israel and lifting up Israel for the benefit of the world.
And that then is what sets the context for verse 16, which, as you said, introduces a sort of summary section and a different kind of idea. The for God so loved the world, the for is a connector word there.
Right.
And
right.
Again, because this verse gets quoted so often by itself, it has become in our minds just sort of part of the background. For God so loved the world, and we start right there in our emphasis immediately on God loving the world and sending his son into the world and all the wonderful things that are in that verse. But pulled apart, it ignores everything we've just said. This is the four. All of these things have been happening. God has been doing this since the creation. There's the Spirit blowing as the wind from creation. And blowing through the life of Abraham, blowing into the life of Israel, settling on the prophets time and time and time again, the Spirit, the wind has blown and the work of God has happened. And I think it is significant to understand Jesus pointing Nicodemus back to that. Look at that and see. You're a teacher of Israel. Look at it. Feel it. See it. Now we understand. And so now God is loving the world and he's giving his only son. And here it is. All who believe in him will not perish, but have eternal life. This is why God has sent his son. And it is about God's salvation of the world, not just the select few.
An individual.
Yeah.
It always amazes me how often, two things, we turn God's promise into a threat. I turn good news into bad news.
Yeah.
Everyone who believes in him may not perish becomes, if you don't believe in him, you will perish.
Yeah. We're quick to jump to the other side.
From a promise to a threat. Or God did not send into the world to condemn the world, but that the world might be saved through him. Somehow we missed that verse. Mm-hmm. And it becomes, in a lot of our lived experience of hearing, unless you believe, and that becomes somehow some work that you need to do, mm-hmm. you're going to perish. As opposed to, wow, look at what God has been doing mm-hmm. and providing this opportunity to all of us. Receive the Spirit. Be open to the Spirit. It's a promise of what God has been doing rather than a threat. And we do that almost all the time.
We get real good at that.
yes,
you know, that's kind of what we're known for as the church, if we're not careful.
Yeah.
Maybe the wind of the Spirit will turn us around a little bit on this second Sunday in Lent and have us sit with these questions a little more humbly. A little less arrogantly in terms of having all of the answers.
I don't plunge into smaller words too often in Gospels. Occasionally, some things come up that matter. And in verse 7, the you changes from singular to plural as a signal of the change from the private conversation or the overheard conversation that Nicodemus and Jesus are having to a sermonic piece where Jesus is beginning to speak to the larger group. So it goes from, do not be astonished that I said to y'all, that y'all must be born from above. And so it's moved from this conversation to this moment of including everyone in what we're doing here, which is signals. The second thing I wanted to say that we sometimes get wrong is how often we fail to understand that God's offer is, I'm not saying universal salvation, but it's God's work has been for the world, not just for individuals. Right. And, you know, we narrow it down. God loved the world, but he only picked a few to save. God loved the world and wants to save everyone.
We've been talking about that one a long time too, hadn't we? And, you know, this is clearly a time when it would have been handy to have a Southerner on the translation committee, all right? to be able to use y'all, because that's such a convenient word. Well, that ought to wrap it up today. I don't guess there's much else left for us to do, Bubba, other than to tell everybody bye.
Everybody bye.
Lectionary Lab Live is a Two Bubbas and a Bible production. Our opening theme is Mama Told Me by Frank Anea. We go out this session with La Création du Monde by Darius Milhaud. Opus 81, this is the first movement, The Chaos Before Creation.